You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
Here we are, Blake. It's episode 23.
A lovely number 23.
Why is that?
Dermot Brereton.
Yep.
Number 23, Shane Warne.
Yep.
23, who else? What other?
Oh, Michael famous? Jordan.
Jordan, 23.
Yeah, the most famous of the lot.
I think there was a nightclub at, Warney's nightclub at Crown called 23.
Might have been. Do you go there often?
I've never been there. I would have thought that would have been your sort of thing, mate, out on the dance floor, cutting up the rug.
Yeah, sure. Rug, what sort of dance floors did you go to?
I don't know.
When you're at the discotheque?
No, you know, I tell you, as adventurous as my nights are these days, just all about Netflix.
Yeah.
Hey, talking about Netflix, have you seen the A Life on Our Planet?
David Attenborough? No, I haven't. Is it good?
Well, I'm just going to say, as Molly Meldrum once said, do yourself a favour, jump on, have a look at it. It's such an inspiring story. I got to the end of it and I was inspired by that man and just the energy, the time, the passion, everything. His life has been put into saving our planet.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do the whole spoiler alert on what actually transpires, but it is amazing. But we're going to carry on the theme of saving our planet. This week's guest is none other than Rachel Lowry. Now, for our guests who may not know Rachel Lowry, who is Rachel, Nick?
Well, she's the Chief Conservation Officer for the Worldwide Fund for Nature, otherwise known as WWF. You will recall the logo, though, which is that little panda.
Yeah. We asked Rachel, what do you do? And it is an amazing response. Rachel says, I'm trying to protect nature. That's a big job.
Yeah, it is. So one of the things in that documentary that you were telling me about was that one of the most important things that you can do as a person to help try and preserve our planet is to stop eating meat. And
Or decrease the volume of meat you eat, yes.
Yeah. And what Rachel talks about is our disconnection with nature, and you'll hear a lot about how that's come about. And it's not just about choosing the right products and things like that. There are more powerful things that you can do. And Blake, we also get the answer to that age-old question.
What's that age-old question?
What's it like to wash an elephant?
I think that's the first time I've heard that question.
Look, she's got a lot of enthusiasm and it's really infectious. You'll be changed after listening to this episode. So here she is, episode number 23, our conservation superstar, Rachel Lowry. Blake, do you like stories of people doing?
I love stories of people doing, Nick.
Well, if you out there like stories of people doing and you want us to make more stories of people doing, then like this podcast, subscribe and tell your mates, because the more people we have listening, the more episodes we can make, and that's better for everyone out there who's doing or wants to do.
And as Arnold would say,
do it.
I thought he said I'll be back.
Hey Rachel, welcome to the Doolanders. How are you?
I'm well, thanks Blake. Hi Nick.
Great to see you again, Rachel. Even if it isn't a Teams call.
Yeah, it's second best, isn't it?
Hey, Rachel, can you explain to the Doolanders, our listeners, what do you do?
I have the incredible job of trying to protect nature. That's it in a nutshell. I'm trying to work on behalf of threatened species to make them a whole lot less threatened and trying to make sure that our wild places stay that way.
That is a big gig. There's a lot of doing in that. When you think about our connection with nature, and the urbanisation of the globe,
How connected are we these days, do you think, in comparison to, say, we were 20 years ago? And is our connection less, do you think, or more?
Look, I think there is enough evidence out there to show that the disconnection is genuinely happening. You know, as we start to turn towards technology more and more and we get busier, disconnection, not just from nature, but sometimes from one another, you know, and that sort of community centered way that a social species should be connected. But having said that, I don't think that disconnection necessarily means that people don't care about nature. And there's also plenty of evidence out there to show that the levels of care, like we do genuinely care, we value it. Yeah. There are, you know, backyard barometer reports in Australia that report on the things that Australians care about. And it's always really strong. We care about our beaches. We care about, you know, having forest access to walk through. We care about our parklands. We care about the koala. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We care, but whether or not that care translates to a genuine connection that every day, is it on our radar? Is it something that we get out there and smell and see and touch and live amongst? Well, that connection's definitely diminishing as, you know, as we progress towards the age of technology, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly is. And hey, we'll dig into that, dig into your purpose a little bit later on, but you say that you were actually born with the nature gene. What does that mean, and you know, how did that shape you as you were growing up?
Yeah, look, I genuinely do believe there must be some naturalist gene, because I feel as though, having been in the conservation sector and made a career out of it for 20 years, I meet people that, just like me, when they're asked this question around, you know, was there this pivotal moment where suddenly you cared? I just don't ever remember a single time where I didn't care about nature. I was genuinely so interested all my life. And I was one of those kids, and you hear about them, we've all seen them, that was just trying to get outdoors. I didn't want to be indoors. And I would love the company of any animal, like, you know, I could be near. I mean, I used to jump fences to get next to people's pets. You know, my parents were like, oh gosh, where's she gone? Because I just loved the company of animals. So I think there must be something. I don't think it was necessarily this pivotal moment, but you know, some of my earliest memories as a child were, and my happiest memories were, when I was just outside in nature,
yeah,
just enjoying it or trying to protect it.
Yeah we were talking earlier on in the week, and you were recounting a story about building bridges over puddles. What's that all about?
Yeah, look, it's a bit of a silly one, but it's a memory that means a lot to me, because, you know, we talk about this idea of doing, and yeah, it's one thing to care for something, it's one thing to like it or even love it, but how do you translate that into action?
Yeah.
And my first memory of action in favor of nature was, I reckon I was prep. I think it was school holidays. It was winter school holidays. I was on my dad's farm. The rain was heavy. And I remember just stepping out of the car, and everyone was running into the house. And this tiny little duckling something had happened to it, and it was dead in a puddle. And in my five-year-old state of mind, I remember just feeling this immense sadness that this duckling was dead. And I jumped to the conclusion that it had drowned, because the puddle had water and the duck was in it.
Yeah.
And so that was it. For the rest of my school holidays, I rallied up my two younger brothers and my younger sister, and it was Operation Bridge Building over puddles. I was very much like, there will not be another duck on this property that will drown. And my dad was thrilled, because we were really busy over the school holidays. So, you know, terrific. Not so great later when my grandfather went to mow the lawns and it, you know, broke his mower. But the meantime, you know, the reason the memory means a lot to me is because another thing I've seen a lot over the last 20 years is well-intended actions that people genuinely care and they try their best, but those actions are sometimes misplaced, and we've got to be really, really careful that we're grounded in science. And so for me, I reflect on that story and think, I've always been at it, trying my best to help wildlife, to help wild places, but I don't want to spend a career building bridges over puddles, right? We don't have time for that. And so I often will get this tiny question in my mind when I'm signing something off as a conservation director, or we're building a plan with an impact avenue towards something big. Like, is this a building bridges over puddles moment, or are we really going to achieve something here? So, yeah, I mean, it's a story that's a bit of a silly one, but it's important because sometimes good intentions just aren't enough, right?
Yeah, spot on. And in terms of your intentions as, you know, as you grow up, you wanted to be, you've spent a long time in zoos, and we'll come to that in a minute, but originally you wanted to become a vet, is that right?
Yeah, I did, because like I said, as a kid, I loved animals. I just loved them. And so when you get when you're a kid, you get told if you love animals, oh, you're going to be a vet one day. You must be a vet. And so I just thought, of course, that's what I'm going to do. It's what I'm going to be. And I found myself, you know, when you go to work experience when you're in high school at a veterinary clinic, and I already had this sense I was going to be a dreadful vet, but I just thought, well, I love animals, so there's nothing else I can do. But I just remember this day where the vet that I was working under, he had to put one dog down and save the other, and they had the same illness, but one had an owner with money and one didn't, you know. And I just thought, oh, I'm going to be dreadful at this, because, you know, I came home just begging my parents every night for the whole month of my work experience, can we take this animal, can we take that one? So I think it's probably the good that I didn't end up a vet in the long run, but I discovered the world of zoology. And, you know, interestingly enough, nobody when I was younger had said, oh, you love animals, you're going to be a zoologist. It wasn't really until I was at uni picking subjects that I went, tell me more about that.
And so out of uni, you wandered into the Werribee Open Range Zoo. Is that right? Was it straight out of uni you wandered in there?
Yeah, yep, absolutely. So I did a Bachelor of Science, and then I read this thing on a website that was the Zoos Victoria's mission, and it said, you know, towards a future where people live in harmony with wildlife. And I went, oh, sign me up for that. So I actually applied for a job called a live encounters officer, and it was Melbourne Zoo originally, live encounters officer. And I thought, cool, like that sounds like that job's going to get action with some cool animals, like sign me up. I didn't realize really until I was closer to getting the job that it meant dressing up as a giant butterfly and teaching kids about the life cycle of butterflies. And nonetheless, I was so keen by that stage to get in. Yeah. And I didn't realize that in the interview they were much more interested in a subject I'd taken in high school around drama than they were, you know, the 2 degrees that I had under my belt.
How well do you play a butterfly, by the way?
I was Priscilla and I was fantastic at it, yeah, I have to say, surely. But, you know, yeah, nailed it. And from there, did some zookeeping. And from there, yeah, zoo-based education, moved into campaigning, and then found myself as director of conservation at the zoo for a good 8 or 9 years before I left and moved on to WWF, Worldwide Fund for Nature.
And just for our listeners out there who might be thinking being a zookeeper sounds unreal, because it's immediately you think you're throwing steaks to the lions, what is it really like? What are the sort of the daily things that you have to do as a zookeeper?
Yeah, no, it's a funny one, because my zookeeping gig was elephants and seals. And so I remember like the very first time I was given this big sort of like a big looking brush and they asked me to wash the elephant down. And I thought, oh, this is so cool. This is an elephant. Like I'm washing an elephant. And like 5 days later, I was like, oh, I'm washing an elephant. This is harder than a car. Like this is just, my arms really hurt. And you know, you have to pick up a lot of elephant feces in that job, and it's like shoveling bowling balls every hour. So,
yeah.
So, I mean, I'm not saying it's not for everyone. Some people love being an elephant keeper, but there is definitely a physical side to the job that I remember just my muscles hurting the whole time.
And what? How did you get out of the enclosure to start moving to essentially the back office?
Yeah, look, it was interesting. When I was a zookeeper, one of the jobs that you do is 3 times a day you give keeper talks. And I found myself loving doing that because it was an opportunity to educate the public around the threats that those animals were facing in the wild. And so I found like it was just my favourite part of the day. And I'd always put my hand up and go, I'll do the keeper talks. And I would hang back and just talk to people and answer questions. And I was really focused on, you know, actions that people could do to help wildlife. And so it became pretty clear that I was going to move into campaigning. And I ended up applying for a job within the education team. And then from there, becoming quite interested in conservation psychology. So I actually built a case for the zoo to start running conservation campaigns. I said, well, how come just school kids can come to the zoo and, you know, enjoy these campaigns? Like, I reckon everyone needs to know exactly what we need to do to save these animals. And from there, the zoo really embraced it, and it was just an incredible decade that followed in just bringing a whole heap of wonderful campaigns to life. It was really, really good fun.
When you think about those campaigns that you ran, you know, are there particular campaigns that stick out in your mind that were successful and made a difference throughout that sort of 10-year period?
Yeah, definitely. Look, every campaign I've ever ran in my conservation career, I've learned something from, at least something. But the one that really sticks out in my mind was the Don't Palm Us Off campaign. So, you know, at that point in time when we were designing that, we had a social scientist do some research, and we realised that less than half of Australians, or just around half, had no idea that palm oil was in their food and where it was coming from, which was orangutan habitat. And, you know, I used to think it was sad and it was unfair that people would stand and look at these orangutans and admire them and bring their kids in sometimes every week. You know, there are some zoo goers out there that just adore these animals. They know them by name and they sit there with their kids and they're going home and making dinner with stuff that's ultimately driving that animal species towards extinction. And that particular campaign was an incredible one because at the time when it started, none of Australia's major food manufacturers were importing certified sustainable palm oil. And by the end, all six of Australia's largest food manufacturers were. So, you know, the power of consumers speaking up and saying, what?
Yeah.
Hang on a second, I don't want to be involved in a loss of a species was just, yeah, humbling. It was an incredible campaign, actually. And it's still going because there's still a lot of work to do. But now, at least Australia is receiving certified sustainable palm oil in the bulk of our foods, which is a good step forward.
Yeah, it is an amazing campaign, and I've seen that still going today in that part of the zoo. What part of zoos are entertainment and what part are conservation, and what's the balance that you need to find within that type of organisation?
You know, I think that one of the reasons I loved working at the zoo for as long as I did, and I think, you know, we need to be mindful, I spent 18 years of my life working in zoos and serving on international zoo boards. Not all zoos are equal, first of all, so I will say that. There are good zoos and there are bad zoos. I truly believe that. But one thing that zoos do, which I place a huge amount of value on, is merge conservation and entertainment. You know, we've got to get better at making fighting extinction and saving wildlife fun, because we all do what we enjoy, and we need more people to enjoy taking action for wildlife. And so, you know, I think when zoos get it right is when you actually can't say this part's education or this part's entertainment and this part's conservation, that the sweet spot is where all good zoos should operate, you know. And if you go to Melbourne Zoo and you look at those rescued seals that they have, for example, go to one of their shows and listen to them talk about the bubbles campaign, blow balloons and not bubbles. Like, the kids are having a ball, you know. There's a bubble machine blowing bubbles everywhere and they're watching seals do their exercise for the day. But the message is powerful. It's talking about the impact of balloons and what happens when we release them en masse and ingestion. And to me, that's conservation and entertainment married together. And the number of kids that I've seen go to parties and say, oh, I don't want balloons here, I want bubbles instead, as a consequence of just that experience is quite remarkable, really.
Yeah, it is. And do you think this generation that is being educated and informed today is better educated and informed, and are you seeing more action come out of, you know, the millennial generation? What are you seeing?
You know, it's an interesting one because are they better informed? You know, I talked earlier about my desire to make sure that we're always being grounded by science, and can't help it. You know, I always need a study to say something with in a definitive way because I don't know a couple of decades ago whether or not people were less or more informed truly, but we have access to a lot more information now, and our kids are certainly, you know, getting exposed to information across so many more mediums. So I wouldn't be surprised if our kids are more informed. I would not be surprised. And just the wealth of information and the depth of knowledge we have around our ecosystems is far richer today than it was a few decades ago. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case. One thing we do know, though, is that information does not lead to behaviour change. Yeah. And that has been really largely dispelled by a number of social scientists who say, don't assume that just because you've raised awareness, everyone's going to go and change the way they live now. And in fact, we also know that just caring for something won't change the way people live. You can care for it and still partake in behaviours that drive a species towards extinction, to be really honest. You know, if the behaviour is cheaper, more convenient or whatever else, there are a whole range of factors. So I don't think that necessarily the access to more information is driving more behaviour change. If anything, I worry sometimes that there's so much information that some people kind of go, oh, that's really important, but someone else is going to do it. And we do see that a lot. You know, when I talk to people about certain issues, they're usually pretty alarmed that our government hasn't just taken action on it, you know, or that someone else just hasn't got that under control yet. So I think that that's something we're still going to get a handle on in this day and age, because we all know often what needs to be done. We just think someone else is going to do it.
Yeah. I agree. Like, and I don't know whether apathy is the right word or not, but I certainly, you know, listening to you, I think many, many, many people care. And this is from, you know, an outsider looking in and just, you know, wandering around in our community, and many people care, but maybe they're unsure of what the right action is to take, and as a consequence there's, I don't know, apathy. That's just my layman's view of perhaps what's playing out. But when you think about your gig today, right, so you're the Chief Conservation Officer of WWF, what are the things that you're trying to do today to help nature, to help, you know, and society?
Yeah, well, I think one of the core things that we are trying to do is make sure it is on people's radars in a way that's constructive, in a way that answers that question, that, you know, what is it that I can do? Working really hard to make sure that as an organisation, we're not just sharing the problems, but we're coming up with solutions and we're rallying people behind them. That's just so critical.
Yeah.
I think if we leave people just with the problem, we leave them feeling overwhelmed. And I see that all the time. You know, when I talk to people and say Australia has the highest rates of mammal extinction than anyone else in the world out of any other country, people go, what? But, you know, if you just leave it there, you know, what do you do with that piece of information? And so, you know, a big part of my job and a big part of WWF's job is really working through what those solutions are that are not just building bridges over puddles, right, that are actually going to get us action at the type of scale that we need. And so, you know, you talk about apathy. I often think of apathy as being linked to, you know, people not caring, and I'm really genuinely confident people care. I mean, you just need to look at the recent bushfires. People came out in droves to donate to nature-based response. People literally took the T-shirts off their back to help save koalas. You know, they crossed roads into fire zones to help wildlife. So people care when it's in front of them. It's really, what is it that we can do that would give us the biggest gains for nature right now for Australia? And ultimately, at the end of the day, that's a core part of WWF's role, is making sure we get people onto those solutions.
So let's go back to the highest level of extinction of mammals across the globe. Like, I didn't know that. I'm looking at Nick. Doesn't look like he knew that
Nick
either.
Nick didn't know it either.
No, like, so.
Come on, Nick. We're friends on Facebook. Do you not read my post, man? What's going on?
Well, just because you're doing it. I just hit like and, you know, go, Rachel, time. You're doing it all for us. And that's obviously part of the problem, isn't it?
So what does a Blake or a Nick do to help that massive issue that we've got?
Yeah. So I think that we can take action on a whole range of different, layers here. First of all, we always talk about these everyday behaviours, and often I think people feel like that's not really going to make a difference because it's just me. But, I love starting with, do people know where their toilet paper comes from? Because every time we put our hand on a pack of toilet paper in the supermarket, we're making a choice as to whether or not we're purchasing toilet paper that's recycled or whether we're purchasing toilet paper where the pulp comes from, Central Highlands, Leadbeater's possum habitat. So the fact that we're still logging native forests here in Australia is, that day should have passed a long time ago. Plantations have proven now that they can work and we can get our pulp from there. You just got to put the energy in at the front end of the process. So, there's that. I think the apathy piece, though, Blake, that you mentioned before, there is certainly political apathy in Australia. It's almost kind of part of our culture to be proud that we're not interested in politics sometimes. And I'm sure it's not everyone. I know it's not everyone, but it's like you don't talk about politics at the table and you don't post politics really on Facebook. You don't want to be that person and so on. But the reality is, when we elect our leaders, we really need to make sure that they know what it is we stand for and that nature is something that we value, because we're not only just in Australia the leaders for mammal extinctions, we are in the top 11 worst nations for deforestation and the only developed nation that is a deforestation hotspot globally. So we're cutting down our forests at a rate faster than any other developed nation in the world. So if we just stop at our tissue paper and our toilet paper, it's not going to be enough. We're going to have to at some point switch on to the big decisions and make sure that our political leaders know that they're going to get votes if they take a strong stand on environment. And that's a really easier said than done in Australia, I've got to say. But it's nonetheless, I think every now and then, we see these glimmers of hope come through. And as terrible and as dreadful as the bushfires was, it was a watershed moment for Australia. I really genuinely believe that. It's the first time in my 20-year career I've started a year where the environment was number one concern for Australians. And that was coming through on all the polls. So, what we do with that here forward is really important.
Yeah, it really is. And what are the countries that you look to that are doing it right, or at least better? And how are they doing it right?
Yeah, look, it depends on when we're talking about doing it right, what aspect, So if we're talking about climate and climate action, for example, then there are a lot of countries throughout Europe that are investing in renewables and are seriously investing in the R&D to try to make sure that they can move off fossil fuels. And I think one of the reasons we're seeing so many European countries embrace it is because it's still, for those people that lived through the 80s, they had acid rain, right? It's still in their living memory that their everyday behaviours can impact the environment. They don't really find it that hard to believe that what we do on a day-to-day basis can impact the environment. When you've lived through acid rain, you're kind of willing to believe that a lot easier than, say, in Australia, where we haven't necessarily experienced that. So it's a harder case to push. In regards to forestry, it's a hard one because, we can't look to Europe because they've done a dreadful job of clearing, really. And deforestation is a major issue sort of worldwide. I'm trying to think of who would be leading there. There are patches, but in all honesty, I think the climate action may be what ends up helping us keep trees in the ground rather than the fact that it's habitat and home for wildlife, because that case hasn't served us all that well. But we are starting to find now parts of the world, throughout Asia, throughout America, some parts of Australia, where people realise that the trees that are actually standing are more valuable than cutting them down. And so, you know, hopefully we can get to the forefront of that pretty soon and turn things around here in Australia. That's certainly my hope. And we'll see carbon farming really picking up, I think.
Yeah. And when you go back to the mammals, Is it the destruction of their habitat that is the major cause of extinction rates?
Yeah, destruction of habitat's huge, and so is the impacts of introduced species, right? Right. And so, look, I think if we were looking at what's the single biggest thing right now, where we, as of today, that Australians could do to really turn that particular scorecard around, yeah. It's not a race we want to win. You know, it's actually making sure we've got strong nature laws that are being enforced, because we have these nature laws in Australia called the EPBC Act, Environmental Protection, Biodiversity and Conservation Act, and they basically set the rules for what we can and what we can't destroy when it comes to threatened species habitat. The right. biggest challenge we've got in Australia is, although we've got those laws, they're just not being enforced. So, like, the last decade, we've lost threatened species habitat on the mainland of Australia in excess of the size of Tasmania. You know, you could lay the whole of Tasmania over. And it's sort of hard to get your head around, but there's good mapping that shows that. It's published, that data. The koala was listed as invulnerable across eastern Australia in 2012. The whole reason as vulnerable. It's vulnerable, right? Which means it's a step towards extinction.
Yep.
The reason you list a species is to send a signal to say, whoa, we've got to do things differently. Since 2012, we've accelerated the clearance of its habitat. We haven't reduced it. And so we need to make sure that our nature laws are strong and they're being enforced. And at the moment, they're under review. And I would say that the single biggest thing Australians could do right now is make sure that our federal government know that it's got to be a turning point for us, right? We've just lost 3 billion animals predicted in the recent bushfires. It's just a staggering loss. This has to be a full stop. We have to turn it around from here.
And, you know, you said at the beginning of the year, you've wandered into the year, and after the, you know, the catastrophe that was the bushfires, there was this platform for discussion and for a real focus on conservation and saving wildlife. Has COVID interrupted or, you know, dampened that platform? What's your take? Can we resurrect that level of discussion and focus at the back of COVID?
Yeah, look, I'm counting on it. I really think the bushfires were so harrowing that it's in our living memory and it's imprinted in a way that I don't think even a pandemic will make it lost from our memories for good. But there's no doubt that just as we had this aha moment, as climate scientists were coming out saying, look, we've modelled this. So there was a discussion around climate action and the fact that they had predicted that our fire seasons would be longer, more intense, more frequent. And at the same time, we were getting our head around the scale of, you know, 19 plus million hectares of land burnt and 3 billion animals lost. Suddenly we're hit with this pandemic. And there's no doubt that has displaced and slowed down action politically. And you can almost forgive that because, you know, our politicians are in the middle of a pandemic. It's all hands on deck, right? Let's protect human lives. And I definitely get it. But federally, you know, our Prime Minister released $2 billion for bushfire response, and just under 10% has gone to nature-based response. So that's where I would say the scale of loss on the nature front was so huge, and I think Australians expect more than just a 10% investment in that. It just doesn't even touch the sides of what we need. And I really genuinely believe had COVID not landed, there would have been a really strong platform to shed light on that. But it's you know, almost like biding our time to make sure that we get through this pandemic. But we're going to have to pick it up. It's going to be really critical. The other threat from COVID, of course, is, you know, we're so focused on our economy and stimulating our economy right now. And so there's both a threat and an opportunity there, because there are so many smart ways we can stimulate our economy. Like, we want to talk about smart. Like, let's move Australia towards being a renewables powerhouse. Like, there are very few other nations that are set up to do that. You know, we invest one of the lowest in research and design in the renewable space out of developing nations. But like, let's turn that around. Let's create jobs. We invented the solar cell. We've got this. If we want it, it's there for the taking. But unfortunately, the way we've invested in our economy in Australia, and the reason we're running the wrong and winning the wrong races, has been development at all costs, you know, right on top of threatened species habitat or fossil fuels, making sure that thermal coal, and now it's gas, is the flavour of the day. And so, you know, COVID is accelerating some of those investments at a time when we need to pause and make smarter investments. So, you know, a lot of ENGOs, there's never been a better time to support your environmental non-government organisations, because they've got the solutions, they've drawn on eminent science groups and experts, and we've got to just try to back in some of those solutions so that we don't run off into an accelerated direction we don't want to go on.
That's going to take some courage from a whole bunch of politicians to not think about just the next election result and a longer term future for, you know, the people of our country and the globe, really. You're on a bunch of boards. You sit on boards and you've chaired boards previously. When you think about, you know, the clout of the people on those boards and the smarts of those, the education and the action that those boards want to take, is it enough to fill the politicians up with courage to make that leap? What's your take?
I don't know if it's about courage for politicians, if I'm really honest with you. There's an ideology. You know, we elect people in that have a certain ideology, and ideology is really, really hard to shift. I think it's going to be the courage of everyday Australians to basically make it politically palatable. Like, it's just not going to be able to be feasible to get elected if you don't stand for a regenerated Australia, for an Australia that's taking the lead on climate action, for an Australia that's investing proper funds into nature-based bushfire response, for an Australia that's turning around our deforestation rate. You know, the courage is going to have to come from Australians. It won't come from our politicians, particularly the ones necessarily elected right now. Although I shouldn't use a broad brush, there are some really great politicians out there right now that are speaking up across all parties. But nonetheless, you know, what I see on boards is that there is this rising awareness across most sectors of Australia, I think, that we're going to have to start doing things differently. You know, that it's that that aha, like, okay, I think the data's pretty compelling now, and it's getting harder to ignore. But what that different looks like, you know, you need to take that leap of faith when you're on a board, when you're in a corporation that's done something the same way for a long time, to almost embrace innovation in a genuine way. Like, how do we disrupt things for the better? Because, you know, business as usual is just not going to get us to where we want to get to. But letting go of habits and letting go of comfort is really hard. And so, you know, I think Australians are innovative. You know, we invented Wi-Fi, we invented the solar cell, we invented FPOS. We can do it. We will do it. And I think we will see most of it come from the corporate sector and probably not from government in the next couple of years. But hopefully by the time we start to see these election cycles coming round, I'm still hoping bushfires was that watershed moment for Australians where we start no longer just assuming that, yeah, they care about the koala too. Because I think there's good enough data to show they might care, but we're not getting results on that front. You know, we will, the three of us, assuming we live to the ages we are expected to from an average life expectancy, will still be alive at the time that New South Wales records koala extinctions based on its current rate. So, you know, the modelling shows us that Eastern Australian koalas are really in trouble. And we talk koalas because they're a icon, but obviously if koalas are in trouble, you can imagine everything else in between that needs a bit of help.
Yeah.
So if you're looking at getting voters to drive the most amount of change and politicians react quite well to getting votes, is it as simple as starting with the toilet paper type conversation and saying, think about the things you're buying, starting to change mindsets in consumer behaviour, and they then start going, okay, well, I should think about toilet paper and toothpaste and milk and all of these sorts of things, and identifying the things they should and shouldn't be buying, to then taking that into their corporate world, because the risk you run is, I've bought recycled toilet paper, I've got solar panels on the roof, I've sort of done my part.
Yeah, so I think that never ever going to discourage people from being wise consumers. Like, absolutely, let's bring that on. It's a powerful space to play in, but we are going to have to go beyond that really now if we're going to sort of accelerate impact at the scale we're going to need. And so, you know, switching on to politics, and actually, I know it's not always viewed as cool, but you know, when was the last time you reached out to your local MP and told them that something was important to you? Or I know that people often think that signing a petition doesn't make a difference. Let me tell you now, it often really does. I've seen it time and time again. And so just making sure that our politicians are hearing from us is honestly one of the most powerful things we can do. And so we've somehow got to turn that around. And even if it's just a simple email to say, hey, just letting you know, nature laws are under review at the moment. You represent our municipality, our area. Would be really wonderful if you can make sure that everyone knows there's an opportunity to strengthen our nature laws right now. Just a simple note like that can seriously change an agenda. They don't even need to get that many of them a lot of the time.
Right. Okay. Nick, let's make a pact. We should do that.
All right. On it. Tomorrow, first thing.
Done. Hey, Rachel, I'm listening to what you do, and my goodness, it sounds so big and so hard. It must feel like, you know, some days that you're taking two steps forward and three steps back. And what keeps you fighting the good fight? What keeps you doing the doing?
Look, I think there's probably a number of things to that. One, on a macro level, I look at what the humanitarian sector has achieved. You know, quite often we buy this narrative that things are worse today than they've ever been. And it's just not true on all fronts. Like, yes, our environment's in a fair bit of trouble if we don't turn that around and take action soon. But, you know, there are less, you know, child mortality rates are dropping. There are more girls and boys in school. Right around the world than there ever were before. There are less women dying when giving childbirth. The rates around the humanitarian space and what we've managed to achieve around poverty reduction, we're not there. I know there are still many people living in poverty, but the ratios are dropping. And that's because there was bold, strong vision at the UN level and beyond where people went, nah, every kid needs to be in school. Let's make a pact. We won't stop until every child is in school. Now, someone could say, oh, that's not realistic. We'll never get every child in school. That's what I hear all the time when I say we should accept no more extinctions. You know, it's a first principled basis. We should not tolerate any species going extinct. And I have people say, oh, that's not realistic. We'll never be able to stop every species going extinct. The point is, that's the right vision. And if you believe in it, you throw everything behind it. And at some point as a society, we've made so many decisions like that. We've kind of said, no, it's okay. Women can go to work. Talk about apartheid. There are so many changes in society where people have suddenly taken a first principled stance and gone, we're not going to stop until we get there. That'll happen. I really genuinely believe, and I think it's in motion. It's going to happen for our environment. It's going to have to. And at some point someone will say, how many extinctions? No way, no more, and we'll get behind it. In the meantime, the things that keep me going are sometimes the smaller wins. Like when I joined WWF, one of the coolest campaigns that they were running at the time when I joined was, for years they tried to get these commercial gillnets out of the Great Barrier Reef, a World Heritage site where mass fishing is occurring and impacting all sorts of species in a World Heritage Site.
Gosh.
The Queensland government wouldn't have a bar of it. No, no, we're not going to ban gill nets. So the WWF decided, all right, we'll raise money and buy the fishing licences. And they've literally, like, the number of people across the community who pitched in so that WWF could purchase the licences and pull the gill nets out, just incredible. So things like that kind of make me go, you know what, like, there's, where there's a will, there's a way, and we'll keep at it and we'll keep working through it. And again, bushfires, as harrowing as it was, and it was truly a hard thing to experience, like, the number of people that just came out and went, hang on a second, like, I'm going to put my hand in my pocket and donate to orgs like WWF and others, was just awe-inspiring. So, you know, it can be hard, and we're not winning every battle, that's for sure, but there's enough there that keeps me going, that's for sure. Yeah.
It's 8:58 p.m. On a Thursday night in September, and where I sit, you're as inspiring at 8:58 p.m. as I reckon you probably have been every moment of every day as you go about what you're doing. How's the juggle with, you know, what you do and pursuing the purpose that you've got? You've got kids and a family, and, you know, how do you glue all of that together?
Yeah, look, the same way everyone does, I think. You just sort of fake it till you make it, and and you take it day by day. I think 2020's been hard. I mean, I'm based in Melbourne, so I've now passed, I think, 130 days in isolation, and the last however many without school and childcare. So 2020 is not the the regular year. So, but normally I've got an incredible husband and we just are a good team and we just make it work. You know, I've always had roles, particularly in the last decade, where I have a responsibility as a director that raises funds to do good things out there in the wild to make sure that the money's going to where we say it's going, which means I have to travel sometimes. I try to limit it, but I need to actually go and see it as a matter of due diligence so that people know their money's going to where we say it is. And that can be hard when you've got young kids, but you know, I'm one of those people that never looks at it as dad's babysitting back at home. He's just back at home parenting. And you know,
exactly. Yep.
It's amazing how many people when I travel say, where are your kids? But my husband doesn't get asked that. So we've still got a bit of a way to go there. But you know, it's a constant juggle. You're absolutely right. And we're just trying to raise our kids as team members, right? So everyone's got their role and we all just pitch in and take our turns at being the ones that gets the attention or being the ones that I have to take one for the team every now and then.
And how are those team members going? How's the three-year-old feel about being a team member?
Look, let me put it this way. We're a team of four and three of us are doing really well. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, one of us, let's just say it is the three-year-old because they're icons for disruption, have kept us on our toes during this lockdown. You know, I've emerged from Zoom conferences and she's tattooed her face with a permanent marker.
Yeah.
Or had a mechanical car stuck in her hair and I've had to cut it out with scissors. You know how it goes. I was doing a presentation the other day to 100 people on Zoom and she threw a bag of marshmallows at my head. So, you know, it's nothing quite like trying to earn people's respect when you're imparting important messages and a good old pink marshmallow comes your way.
Yeah, and that
dust sticks too, doesn't it? The old marshmallow dust.
Oh.
That's gold. And wasn't there a flying scooter at some stage? What happened there?
Yeah, that was yesterday's. Terrific, you know, I just thought I'd clock off from work, take the kids for a quick scoot, and, of course, I got a call from head of policy at WWF who just needed a quick sign-off on some narrative that we were trying to get up towards a political bill. And, yeah, I couldn't even finish the call because my three-year-old managed to throw a scooter at my eight-year-old. And so I am juggling with the exact same challenges everyone else in lockdown has with their kids, and all you can do is laugh through it. I actively actually try to share these stories with my team, because I just think one of the best things we can do as leaders of organizations is just remind people that we all have this juggle. We've just got to be kind to ourselves, but especially kind to our kids. You know, like, lockdown's been hard for us. Imagine being a kid and not really being able to get your head around it. Like, why can't I go to the park anymore?
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, it's all about, I lead with empathy, and I think we just get through it, right?
Yeah, spot on. Hey, Rachel, last question. So advice for people that are listening that are really leaning in to drive change and transformation, regardless of what, you know, that cause might be, what would your advice be?
No, I tend to think, because I started by saying I think I've got the naturalist gene, I know that not everyone does. So my advice to people is this: just make sure you just keep tuning in when you hear these issues, whether it's environment, whether it's, you know, asylum seekers, whether it's you know, any marginalized members of our community, etc. Just tune in and just try to put your weight behind what's fair and what's right. And I think in the environmental space, that drives me a lot of the time. It's just, you don't have to love koalas, you don't have to love possums, you don't really have to. At the end of the day, you'd have to love orangutans. It's not really fair if you're buying food and you don't know whether palm oil is in it or not. It's not fair to you. Like, you know, you at least deserve to have palm oil labeled on your food so you can have that decision, right? And it's not really fair to any of our kids if we're cutting forests down faster than any other country that's developed in the rest of the world. Like, who is that fair for, other than the people who are getting money off the back of the pulp? And it's not fair to anyone if we're investing in opening new coal mines right now with everything we know. It's like, who is that actually fair to, genuinely? And so there's this sense of fairness that has to start prevailing, and that would be my advice to anyone out there who might not be motivated by koalas, because I get it, not everyone is. It's just that, what's the fair thing to do? And we need to actually start making sure that we get behind and make those fair decisions, and we ask our leaders to do the same.
Just do what's fair and right. Sounds pretty reasonable, doesn't it?
I reckon.
Hey, Rachel, thank you so much for being on the Dolanders. What you do is truly inspirational, and thank you for sharing your story with us and our listeners.
Super fun, guys. Thank you.
Thanks, Rachel.
So what do you think of Rachel Blake?
Oh, blown away. Like, I think about at the start of the year when we all witnessed that absolute catastrophe of the bushfires that raged right across Australia. I think Rachel mentioned in the app that there were over 3 billion reptiles, birds, mammals that were actually killed through those bushfires. And I remember, like, it was the first time in a long time that there was a real spotlight and a real focus on what are we going to do to help sustain these species. And then COVID dropped.
Yeah.
And that spotlight was lifted.
Yep.
How do you reckon we will that spotlight come back on again?
Well, you certainly hope there won't be fires this summer in Australia, but there's every chance, you know, that sort of thing could happen again. Look, I think what Rachel really clearly pointed out was, is, yes, go and buy the right toilet paper and think about your products, but it is really hard when you're in a supermarket making the right decisions about what I'm actually purchasing here.
Yep.
Is what is on the packet the right thing?
Yep.
Really tricky.
Top 11 nations for deforestation in Australia.
Yeah, incredible, right? And what she's saying is your vote does matter. We have the laws in place. We have the nature laws in place. They're just not being enforced. So it's about electing people who believe that those nature laws are important and important enough to actually enforce. It's not about voting in one party or one way. Find someone in your electorate who's the right person, and start championing for change.
Yeah. It was clear, and you know, you heard Rachel, she's an expert. It's just not enough to care.
Yeah.
Because everybody cares.
Yep.
Do we care if the koala becomes extinct? Shit, yeah. Of course we do. But what are we doing about it?
Yep.
Do we care that 3 billion animals, reptiles, mammals died? Of course we care. But what are we doing about it?
Yep.
We need to take some action. I think there's some really clear things that came through that you spoke about. You're right. Do the things. When you think about purchasing, do the things that you perceive are fair and right.
Yeah.
And that'll go some way to helping Rachel's cause and Rachel's purpose.
Yeah. And it looks like schools are quite good with kids these days talking about conservation. And I certainly hear my kids coming back talking about this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But unless you lead them, it's just kind of words that they're saying and they sort of understand their mentality, but then they won't understand the difference when they're buying something. So we do need people in positions of power to enforce the laws, to make it so much easier for the end user, which is us, the consumer, to purchase the right products, to understand what it is we're purchasing. Otherwise, it's very easy to sort of say, well, I stuck solar on my roof and I drive an electric car without sort of thinking further down the chain of where do I get my other power from and how is that impacting on the environment? You need those decisions almost made for you by people in positions of power and making sure that the energy companies are doing what they say based on the laws that we have in place. So, and yes, exactly right about koalas. We love these animals. That's why they're using them as the poster child.
Yeah.
Can you imagine an Australia without koalas?
No, cannot. It's staggering. We must make that trajectory change. The other thing that blew me away was she's an educator. It's what Rachel does.
Yep.
And I had one question for you. You know, Rachel went from butterfly outfit to her position today.
Yeah.
Have you ever spent any time in any sort of outfit throughout your career, any sort of, you know, costume?
Well, look, I don't mind a dress-up, but I've certainly never used a dress-up for good in the same way that Rachel has. How about you, Blake?
I've spent a lot of time in and around pantomimes, so yes, I could hear, or actually that discussion that Rachel talked about around the butterfly outfit took me back, being inside rabbits, I'm not sure. Anyway.
Look, I hope you enjoyed this episode, Doolanders. We loved having Rachel on the show and she was good enough to give us her time. We had a couple of delays because she was busy working with the government on new environmental bills. So we're really lucky to catch her at a good time. Hope you enjoyed it.
See you, Doolanders. Hey, Doolanders, if you want to hear more inspiring stories and have this show grow to more and more listeners, do us a favour. Can you like, share, rate and review the Doolander podcast on wherever you get your podcast from?
Wherever good pods are cast.
That's where...